This episode is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. And are you interested in bond trading? At Interactive Brokers Bond Marketplace, you can access over 1 million global bonds, including government, corporate, and municipal bonds, all in one place. With IBKR's bond search tool, finding and comparing yields against other brokers has never been easier, streamlining your investment decisions. Plus, you can trade U.S. Treasuries around the clock 5 days a week, allowing you to react to market news and economic events whenever they happen. Enjoy bond trading with no markups or built-in spreads and low, transparent commissions, which can help improve your returns. Rated a top online broker, Interactive Brokers has won awards from Barron's, Investopedia, Stockbrokers.com, and has been Benzinga's number one overall online broker for bonds 4 years in a row. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers, member SIPC. Visit IBKR.com/bonds and start trading today.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Shocking! Rates running higher on better-than-expected jobs report. Oil's on the move as the Middle East conflict intensifies. And China and emerging markets are on fire, breaking out from long bases. Our guest today is Tim Knight from theslopeofhope.com. All this and much more on episode number 889 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, they say sell Rosh Hashanah, buy Yom Kippur, right? Another old adage that will be put to the test because we're right in the middle of that right now. We'll see what happens. You know, all those sell in May and go away and the Santa Claus rally, the January effect, and oh man, there's so many others, right? Don't fight the Fed. These are things that are regularly tested in the markets. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. We know that what's gone on in the summertime with the sell in May gone away, go away is, it's not really there anymore. But anyway, let's welcome ourselves, all of us, to the world that all news is good news. I'm Andrew Horowitz, and we have a lot to unpack today. A lot going on in the markets, a lot going on in the world of finance. You know, we had a bull on last week. Manuel Bly, he told us all the reasons why we should be invested, why we should be long, why he had a double green lights, which added up to three green lights for investing. And I thought that I would pair it this week with a bear. Yeah. It's going to be interesting. So we'll bring Tim Knight on in a second. We saw a great jobs number on Friday. Some other interesting returns and results throughout the week. Some things that spooked markets a little bit. Some things that were good. We saw that China was again on fire. Still closed for the, I believe, for the Golden Week. But Hong Kong stocks came up pretty dramatically. We're talking about somewhere of a 25% move in the last several weeks as China unleashed that incredible amount of stimulus. Good news for us, at least, and hopefully for you, that we've been on board with emerging markets for a while. China's a big component of that particular index and investment style, and it's done really well. So good news in that area. In fact, when we look at some of the stocks, whether it's Pinduoduo or Alibaba or Even the car maker NIO, the electric car, the EV maker NIO, I mean, they're on fire doing so well. And that is probably aided in the fact of what's going on around the world, because this unleash of the animal spirits in China has trickled down to other areas around the world. And we're going to see a lot of probably give and take right now as we digest exactly if this is going to save, which looked like an unsavable economy, that is one of the biggest in the world. The housing market in China is in disarray. We see what's going on in the banking and financial system. It is disrupting a lot of things. And now that China is allowing for refinancing, they're going to allow essentially for, as we talked about, the investors in insurance companies, investment companies, to tap their central bank for cheap money and use that to buy directly into the stock market. Everybody's like, hey, let's get on board with this. So pretty interesting what's going on right there. Of course, we got to pair that with what is happening in the Middle East, the expansion of that conflict and the worrisome signs of what's going on in Israel and in Jordan and all the surrounding, Lebanon, and all the surrounding areas inside of the Middle East, and how that is starting to percolate in a really bad situation, and why we're seeing that oil has peaked up and perked up, I guess, over the last week or so. It's really interesting because we're seeing a lot of things happening in the area of the Suez Canal, the port strike, which has ended, at least tentatively, as of right now. And all the things that are going on, and you have to wonder how inflationary that's going to be, considering the fact that these are all concerning areas, and the fact that we've seen the better-than-expected jobs numbers on Friday, which, by the way, which should have driven rates up, which they did. Which, in fact, those great numbers should have pumped up the U.S. dollar, rally it, which it did. Which have taken down probably the chance of a rate cut the next go around, taken those chances down as well, which it did, which in fact should have slowed stocks down, which it really didn't, which is the most interesting right now. The resiliency of stocks in the face of all that's going on right now is probably something that is making a lot of people wonder, why? Well, we don't have an answer to that, and I don't think we need to really search for an answer for that. We just know what is. And that's the most important lesson that we can learn from what's going on right now. The lesson that we don't have to really search for an answer. The answer is the answer. The reality is just that. And if you're busy spending your time looking for an answer all the time for all this, like a headline-driven life of why I need to know, it's a waste of time. The fact that the news media needs to pin a label that, hey, markets were up because, let's see, let's give it a label for the weekend. Markets were up on Friday because of a better jobs number, and then the subtext would be meaning that we have a growing market with lower rates. Or what's going on with regard to the stock market? Why is that considerably going up? Or why is rates going up, but yet the chance for rate reduction is staying, relatively, it's still 25 basis points. These are all kinds of things that are conflicting, but yet at the same time, if we're looking for the answer, we could find answers on every side. We could find pros and cons. We could find all rationales of this, but the truth is what is happening is what is happening. And for whatever reason, we don't have to give it a reason. We can say, for whatever reason, the markets are being held up. They're being supportive. That's fine. Go with it. I was at dinner the other night and somebody said, with all that's going on and with the election coming up, should we go to cash? And I said, listen, to be honest, we've had this discussion over the last year, probably four times. And I said, your portfolio, the way we set up for you, is very conservative. And if would have gone to cash, you would have probably returned about 3 or 3.5% this year. And let's say, as an example, at this point, you're up 9% on your conservative portfolio. What would be the benefit of that? Even if we slip back 5%, you're no worse off than you were. So we invest according to what the outlook is, considering all the different inputs that you get, right? That's what you do. That's what we do. That's what you should be doing, at least. And trying to time it is a fool's errand. We know that. But we can place on certain hedges or certain positioning, like overweight emerging markets compared to, let's say, U.S. stocks, as an example. Or look to have a short-term duration to mid-term duration on bonds and not be long duration in a market that has already fell down dramatically in terms of rates and yields, and continue to work on the opportunity of getting a decent yield without a lot of principal degradation if in fact yields turn around like they have done considerably over the last couple of weeks. Just some things that you could do. It doesn't have to be a constant rejiggering of the portfolio and repositioning all the time, although we just did a pretty interesting rebalance for our clients. But the truth is that we can also be invested and hedged a bit, or at least well-rounded a bit and balanced properly and diversified properly into what could be, because there are things that will work in ways that maybe are not as intuitive as we may think, because there are a lot of outside influences on the markets right now. That's truly our answer. There's outside influences that are impacting the markets, and there's money on the sidelines. There's a whole bunch of things that are going on that may be not as intuitive as you would think. The fact that maybe one party, the Republican, Trump, or the Democrat, Harris, gets into office may or may not do. Listen, last time that Trump got into office, it was a bloodbath for about 6 hours. 5 hours, maybe. Then things turned around pretty dramatically. Everybody's thinking, well, and I think this to a degree, if Harris gets in and they're trying to punch up the capital gains taxes substantially and the corporate taxes, could be very detrimental to the stock market end of year. Then again, we have to realize that that may or may not actually come to fruition. It has to go through Congress. It has to be voted in. That may not happen. So some things to chew on as we get to our guest. And let me bring them in right now. And bring him in to introduce who he is. He's been Tim Knight from slopeofhope.com. He's been charting and trading since 87. His first stock trade was, in fact, on October 19th, 1987, the day of the crash, which maybe goes a long way to explaining why his disposition towards bearishness is there. He's been running Slope of Hope since March 29th of 2005 and has, during that time, written more than 30,000 posts on his site. In 92, he founded Profit, a web-based technology and analysis firm that was acquired by InvestTools and later by Ameritrade in January 2005. He served as Senior Vice President of Technology for InvestTools from 05 to 2010. Both Barron's and Forbes consistently named Profit the number one website for technical analysis. Now, besides running the Slope of Hope, he hosts a daily show on Tasty Trade Live Network. It's a Tasty Live Network, trading charts with Tim Knight. So let's bring him right on. Tim, it's good to have you back.
Oh, great to be back. Thank you very much for having me back.
So, the last time you were on was January 2024. The first time you were on, 2013.
Oh my Lord. one day this is going to work out.
You know, it's funny. Yeah. We talked about this. We laugh and joke about it a little bit. But of course, you have a proclivity towards the... You know, the market is too high. It's going to come down. Or when I say that, not only markets, but maybe the bearish side of the equation. I want to just talk first before we get into some of these topics here about actually, as crazy as it may sound, the importance of short selling in a market construct. In that a lot of people are like, oh my God, short sellers should be outlawed. It's a terrible thing and all that. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you think about this comment and take it from there. The people that are buying on the lowest, most god-awful day of any market cycle are probably not those that are looking to buy dips because everybody's so freaked out. It's the short sellers starting to cover, taking their profits. That's what usually will start a initial recovery rally. Thoughts?
Yeah, well, no, I thought what you were going to say, and I'll say what I thought you were going to say, is that those who buy at the very, very bottom are later celebrated for their foresight. Yes. And their acumen and their boldness and their courage. You hardly ever really see anything about someone shorting at the tippity top. And, you know, let's get a statue of that guy. I do think that perhaps the very best of bears out there might start to, as they say, the green shoots, the proverbial green shoots back in early 2009 come out when they get out. But, you know, you mentioned how, short selling should be banned, et cetera. That'll come back. That will come back, because if the day ever comes, I'm starting to wonder if it will, if the day ever comes where we get an honest to goodness, rock 'em, sock 'em, like 18 month, 24 month bear market, in the midst of that, there will be calls about, you know, because they're always painted as like the bad guys. And interestingly, and I'm sure you remember this, back during the financial crisis, and I think the data is burned into my head. I'm going to check moments after I say this because I want to test my memory first. I want to say it was on September 19, 2007, that they announced before the market opened, I think it was a Monday, that we are banning the short selling of these like 900 stocks, you know, mostly financial stocks and so forth. And naturally, on that news, the market rallied like mad for like half an hour. And then all holy hell broke loose and it completely collapsed. So I will say that, you know, if the time comes when you get some grand announcement, some ostensibly well-serving government agency comes out and bans short selling, wait about half an hour and then like put all your net worth in the puts, because the floor is about to give way if they're that desperate.
Yeah, that is a sign of desperation. We see other countries do this as well. And usually it didn't work out. Europe did it with their financial shares. It didn't work out at all.
Yeah. And I just had to check and I nailed it. Yeah. September 19, 2008. That was the exact date. And the Russell 2000 in particular, you can see it was at 761 on that September. And 2 months later, 371. So half its value in 2 months. Now, in this, you know, in this poisonous new era we live in, I don't think anything such thing would be allowed. Because even in 2008, things were sort of kind of like a market still. But regrettably, that's quaint.
No, things aren't allowed to go down now anyway. So that's they solve that problem.
No, maybe a day, maybe two. Yeah. And then they start squealing. So, yeah.
So let's talk about, I don't know exactly what particular flow we should do here, but maybe you may want to weave in. Let's talk about some of the topics we talked about that maybe we can initially start with, and then you can weave in some of the charts that you have. By the way, all the charts that we're talking about today will be on the show notes for episode number 889. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and you can download it. It'll say, hey, download the charts discussed in this episode. And there's a PDF there. You just click the button so you can follow along. So I'm going to tell you that now so maybe you can pause, go there, do that, and you can have it ready. But let's start with the presidential election, how the markets, you know, may react to some of the outcomes. One of the things may be, of course, we've been hearing a lot about capital gains taxes, right? You know, we moving it back to 28% and raising corporate income taxes if Harris comes in, and on the other side, tax cuts again and tariffs if Trump. So give me your thoughts on this.
Sure. Well, it's a funny thing because back when I was a wee lad, back in the 80s, in the early 80s, I got into computers and I was a kid. And at the time, the adults watching me do this said, wow, he must be great at math. I suck at math. I have the distinction of getting the only person in my high school's history to get a 1 on the calculus AP. But the assumption was, oh, computers equals good at math. And I wasn't at all. I just really liked computers. Mm-hmm. And I offer that anecdote to say that, you know, I'm really interested in the markets, and it doesn't have to do with technical indicators or mathematics. It really has more to do with almost like, you know, history and poetry, because I like to see the broad sweep of what's going on in history and try to anticipate what's coming up next. And the thing that's dangerous about the presidential, you know, kind of projections is, I think the simplistic view is, if Trump wins, good for business. If Harris wins, bad for business. End of story. And I can understand, and let me just preface this, I'm not getting into politics. Don't worry. I'm just saying that seems to be.
Sitting their hair on fire, freaking out and, you know,
no.
burning down the
So by no means, the aforementioned statements are not declarations of what I think is going to happen. I just think generally speaking, it'd be a little easier to make that kind of case that a Trump administration would be more business/rich people friendly and Harris more of a kind of redistribution of wealth. Now, back in 2008, when Obama was a candidate, I made the projection, which was dead wrong, that if he wins, because of keeping in mind at the time, the market was already kind of falling apart. The market started falling in autumn of 2007. And I know it seems hard to believe that a bear market could last from autumn 2007 to spring 2009, but it used to be that way, kids. So deep in 2008, when Obama was a candidate, I thought, again, incorrectly, that if this guy wins, boy, oh boy, the market's really going to get clobbered. And couldn't have been more wrong, because 2 months after his inauguration, not even that, like weeks after his inauguration, the S&P was at 666. And, you'd be hard pressed to buy any stock that didn't go up hundreds of percent in the years to come. Yep. And so I think anybody now making any declaration about if A wins, this will happen, if B wins, this will happen, is probably going to be mistaken. And I would also say that it's long been my belief that the president, whoever it may be, in whatever era, just happens to be there at a certain time in the economic cycle. And it's foolhardy to be like, well, you know, gosh, if we only had Bill Clinton back, he would make things great because the economy was good during him. Or, oh my God, George W. Bush, the economy was a disaster. He sure screwed things up. They just happen to be in the White House at that time. They really, I don't think, have a lot to do with the broad, broad sweep. And so one final thing I'll say on this, then I'll shut up for a minute, is my view is that a recession is a foregone conclusion for next year. And I would say, politically speaking, if you really love your candidate, hope the other one wins. Because whoever it is, whether it's Donald Trump or Kamala Harris or Yosemite Sam, whoever's in the White House in 2025 is going to get blamed for whatever happens. And they'll deny, of course, that, oh, it's the other guy, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, ultimately, they're going to get the blame. And they really don't deserve it, whoever it is.
Well, you know, that there's something to be said that people don't realize that, oh, things were really good under this administration, you know, the 4 years. I mean, you want to stretch it to an 8 year, I'll go there. But 4 years, you got 2 year carryover from the previous administration at all times, good or bad. And everybody blames everything on or credits. The job growth or the inflation or the deflation or whatever it is, you know. So do you actually trade? So I traded. I stayed up late and I was working futures on the Trump election. And that was wild.
Yeah. So you're asking if I trade, like trade?
Would you trade like election day, election night, election post?
Oh, goodness gracious. Yeah. No, no exclamation mark. In fact, you know, rare is the time that I'm flat. I'm probably going to be flat. I'm a political junkie. I will be riveted to every millisecond of that night, but I will not be like in position at all. I want to stay way away from the blast zone.
That's smart, because not only is it away from the blast zone, if you are that, this is an interesting point, I think, to the listeners. If you're that interested in politics and maybe you have a particular candidate or party in mind that you desire over the other, it probably would make sense if you, in fact, are a trader to stay away from the keyboard, because your emotions will get way too impacted.
Yeah. No, Andrew, think about 2016. I mean, it was almost like a JFK moment for me, because like I was in Costco it was in the evening, like 5 PM, and I'm on the West Coast. So, you know, returns are starting to come in, and that was when the first inkling of like, you know, the 98% for sure going to win Hillary Clinton may not happen. Mm-hmm. And as it became apparent that Trump might be the guy, futures collapsed. They went limit down.
I remember that.
And, you know, one could easily argue that, you know, because people were like shocked and surprised and what does this mean? And as we all well know, they didn't stay limit down for long. And then it was this huge rally about, you know, oh, by the way, this guy's going to be a total friend to business and tax.
Well, as soon as he said he's reducing taxes, everything went berserk on corporations.
Right. Yeah. But no, in the confines of just those 8 hours over the course of the evening, there was a complete V bottom. And it's fascinating to watch. And I will happily look from the sidelines to say, wow, how about
that's
that? Smart. But yeah, there's going to be so much uncertainty. So it's doubly exciting for me to have not just the politics, but the market action. I do not want it triply exciting to actually have any money involved.
Yeah, I would say that's a smart thing to do. I mean, obviously, a lot of things can happen during these kinds of of circumstances. I mean, you know, we just saw, for example, you know, some of the big changes with a whiff, a potential chance of Harris coming in. All of a sudden, the solar stocks took off, as an example. And, you know, and we see that as we're talking about areas of oil and things like that, I mean, just anything like that could really tip a market pretty hard, especially a market that this is kind of high, which maybe we'll talk about that in a second. I want to talk to you about the markets and how the Federal Reserve has impacted them since 2019 and talk about some of the phrases. But before we do that, let's, and I want to get to your charts. Before I do that, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk with Mr. Knight, Tim Knight, about some of the more interesting areas that people don't like to talk about because everybody just likes all the confetti and bubbles and rainbows and lollipops, right? So
right.
Well, let's talk about that when we get back. So let's talk about Interactive Brokers, because Interactive Brokers clients earn up to 4.33% on their uninvested, instantly available USD cash balances. You have to wonder, how much is your broker paying you? Compare IBKR's interest of up to 4.33% to other brokers, and a lot of them pay you only about 0.5%. Interactive Brokers' prudent and conservative risk management uniquely positions IBKR to pay you far higher interest rates. That's just one of the many reasons clients use Interactive Brokers to trade stocks, options, futures, currencies, bonds, funds, and more. Of course, rates are subject to change, but visit ibkr.com/interest rates to learn more. All right, we're back with Tim Knight. We left off, and I mentioned that we're going to talk about the Federal Reserve, some of the actions going back a number of years. And why don't you kind of give me your thoughts on this?
Sure. Well, the Federal Reserve for decades really didn't have a heck of a lot to do with the equity markets. I mean, the stock market was very rightly seen as something that should be left as a market, you know, to do what it does. And that began to change really in 87, because after the strong bull market from 82 to 87, people got very accustomed to things being strong. And when things started to get, you know, when we had the crash, Greenspan came in, and over the course of time, the actions that the Fed took became more and more extreme. So at first, it's like, you know, kind of emergency rate cuts and so forth. And basically, you know, a press release with nothing behind it, just kind of like positive words, often would turn things around. And things really changed in 2008, because it seems almost incredible now, but in the autumn of 2008, you know, Henry Paulson literally got on his knees to beg Nancy Pelosi to approve what these days seems like a quaint small amount, $700 billion, $0.7 trillion to save everything. And Congress said no. And that was, you know, they actually had a backbone to say like, no, you know, this, we're not going to do it. And then some days later, it went back and it got through. So the autumn of 2008 was sort of the last bastion of something resembling an organic market. And then in 2019, you know, and things were humming along with QE and the trillions of dollars of purchases and so forth. And, you know, they were starting to tiptoe toward normalization. And things started, I think it was actually in late in 2018, things started to sort of head south. And they got involved again, but things really went bananas, of course, with COVID. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, the COVID crash was very short lived. I mean, basically, we peaked Feb 19, 2020, and the bottom was March 23, 2020. So we're talking 4 weeks. And in 4 weeks, the market absolutely, what happened in 4 weeks usually took about 18 months in the past. And that was the bottom. That was the big bottom back on March 23, 2020, which it was 4 years ago. It feels like 40 years ago because so much has happened since then. But the thing is that at that point, it seemed as sensible for the Fed to save, it makes as much sense for the Fed to come in to save the market as it would that your local police coming to stop a burglar. That's what they do. You know, that's the appropriate role of this government body is, you know, if someone's getting held up with a gun, a policeman shows up with a gun and says, put that gun down. That's the appropriate thing to do. That's their role.
Although they're not a government body, technically.
Well, a police force, you know, they're local government.
No, I'm talking about the Fed is not a government body.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, and that's the other thing, because if you and I strolled the streets of this once great republic and asked people, just tell me a paragraph about the Federal Reserve, like what they do and their role and their importance, I think maybe 1%, and that's probably generous, maybe 1% could give a pretty decent answer to that. And yet they basically rule the economy. Mm-hmm. But people have become utterly, utterly accustomed. So now if they came to Congress, like, we need $5 trillion approved, be like, just here's the rubber stamp, but bang, you know, there's no pushback at all. And, you know, this is happening everywhere. It's not just the U.S., be it Europe or China. I mean, this very morning, this whole week, we've been having this sweep of hundreds of billions of yuan being distributed by China to prop things up. And what I've long contended is that works, and it will keep working until it stops working. And when there will come a day, and I don't know if it's going to be the year 2190 or if it's going to be next week, but there's going to come a day when some different government says, throws the spigots open, says, anything you want, here's all the money you want, and the markets don't respond, then it's like, then it's game over. Because like this, you're trying to light wet kindling at this point. Mm-hmm. It's not working anymore. Mm-hmm. So
they're going to continue on, though. They're not going to stop. I mean, they can't stop nonstop. No. You know, they're just going to be doing their thing. So, I mean, I think we need to put that into our playbook. But the problem is that there is either one or two, I guess, outcomes. There's many different outcomes. One or two possible outcomes that I see, right? So one is we end up like Japan, which is terminally going to participate in every single aspect of economic slumps and just keep on pumping as best as they can, reducing the currency to extinguish debt, keep on providing debt, and then eventually get involved in the markets, which we can say with a somewhat straight face that at least our Fed doesn't buy stocks in the open market, right?
Yeah, it is kind of sad that there's countries that are even worse than the U.S. in terms of, like, you know, I think they're responsible for like the vast majority of like all ETF purchases. They've become the market. I mean, it's complete. They're their own virtuous cycle, and the public's just kind of standing staring at them. So yeah,
interesting.
But you know, yeah, the thing is that, and some of your listeners may be acquainted with you know, this book Fourth Turning, which is a book about long historical cycles, and it's not an economics book. It's really more of a book about, in a multi-millennial view, just how society / and the society's economy move through ups and downs in four discrete cycles. And the title Fourth Turning refers to what the authors anticipated was coming in the late 90s, which I think we're right in the thick of right now. And so for those of your listeners who are interested in this kind of long-term, multi-decade, multi-century historical sweeps, Fourth Turning is kind of the Bible on this stuff. And it's pretty shocking, because if you read it, and it was written in 97, as you read it, their accuracy about what was going to happen in a few years is pretty jaw-dropping. I'll just read, if I may, read one or two sentences here. Yeah. I've written about this book many times as a reference. If any of your listeners have it, on page 273, the authors are talking about sort of what they saw coming up in the next few years. And so they had like five bullet points. One of the bullet points was a global terrorist group blows up an aircraft. United and allies launch a preemptive strike. And so obviously that brings to mind like 9/11. Mm-hmm. And the other real eye-popping one was the Centers for Disease Control announced the spread of a new communicable virus. This disease reaches densely populated areas, killing some. Congress enacts mandatory quarantine measures. The president orders the National Guard to throw prophylactic cordons around unsafe neighborhoods. Mayors resist. Urban gangs battle suburban militias. And there's calls for martial law. So obviously COVID right there. Mm-hmm. And to be clear, this isn't some book by some whack jobs or like, you know, new Nostradamus. This is a serious study of human history and their attempt to build a framework around those ups and downs and anticipate what they think is coming next. And so that definitely plays a part in kind of my thinking about what we're up against, because we're deep in the fourth turning now. And I think the next year or two are going to be just shocking.
So this reminds me, you mentioned a book. So tell me about you. You wrote a book, you wrote a novel.
I've actually written 25 books, but I've never written a novel before. I started writing books when I was 16. And
I wrote two. Yeah, you know how many more I'm going to write?
How many?
None. Okay. I wrote two books. Yeah, they were great. I love them. And they say what they need to say. That's it.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I've never been a novel reader. In fact, I like to say that I've written one more novel than I've ever read, which is pretty close to the truth. Because the 24 books I wrote before it were about computers and the financial markets and charting and things like that. And they were all nonfiction, to say the least. And I've been thinking so much about society and technology and the economy and how things are changing that I had all these ideas bubbling about. And so I set about to write a book, and it turned out to be this monster of a book. It's 73 chapters long, but it was a very interesting project, and it's free, by the way. If any of your listeners are interested, because I make $0 off of this, but my desire is for people to read it, not to make any money. So the easy thing to do is like you could Google just like Tim Knight Solid State, and that would get you to the site. If you want to go directly, it's over on Substack. So they could just type solidstatenovel.substack.com.
No.
And you know, it's the book, you know, it's 73 chapters, it's 500 pages. I can't condense it into something neat and nice, but I'm very proud of it. And I genuinely think that, that your listeners would enjoy it.
Cool. Let's skip over to the chart, shall we?
Yeah, I think we better.
As I mentioned, all these can be downloaded in a very easy package. Go over to episode number 8. What are we on? 889. So the show notes will have a link. Where do you want to start? Which one do you want to start with? I guess the first
sure.
one.
Sure. Well, they all kind of draw the same conclusion. I mean, there's 6 charts, but they all say the same thing. So I'm just going to start, and spoiler alert, I'll just say what I intend to say, and then we'll walk through them. My contention here is that the relationship between precious metals and equities speaks volumes about what I think is to come. And in a nutshell, I am and have been very bullish on precious metals, in gold in particular, and conversely, I am bearish on equities. So we'll begin with gold. The first chart is the one, and all these have watermarks on them, so the watermark is GC/UUP. And this chart goes back to 07, and it's what they call a ratio chart, and all it is the continuous contract of gold futures divided by the US dollar index. And as can be seen, back in 2011, 2012, 2013, there's that pink topping zone, mm-hmm. and so things fell. And then for years, we have that green base right there, and it pushed it higher. And then more recently, from about 2020 to now, we had beneath that dashed green line a nice base form, and it's shooting up. And so what it shows, this is not a projection, this is reality, what it shows is that gold is vastly outperforming the US dollar, which isn't always the case. People might assume it always does that, but that's not the case. The next chart, so that's gold. The next chart is very long. It's the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And this is all the data I've got. It goes back to the year 1900.
This is Dow Jones Industrial DGA/GC.
No, forgive me. This is actually the only one without a symbol on it.
I got it. This is the one with the trend channel.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so in this instance, this is the Dow for literally an eighth of a millennium. This is 125 years of data. And as you can see there, this is following this long, long channel. In particular, that red trend line is anchored to the top in October 1929. And it goes all the way up to roughly, about this very second you and I are chatting with one another. Okay. That's where that red line is mashed up against. And so my postulate in this, and it doesn't seem too daring, is that, gosh, stocks sure are high, aren't they? Because over the course of 125 years, this line has held, and we're kind of mushed up against it right now. And so going to the other four charts, and they all kind of say the same thing, but I'll just touch on them real briefly. These are all essentially equities divided by a precious metal. So the RUT slash GC.
Can we go back to the last chart? Hold on. Can we go back to the last chart?
Yeah, the Indu, yeah.
You said there's a red line, there's two trend lines, and a dotted purple line. Would you agree with me there?
Yeah. So just to be clear, that purple channel goes all the way back, and that dashed line, that's the midline between that. So the path of the market isn't perfectly parallel in this case. The lower purple line is anchored to the bottom of the Great Depression, as well as the kind of 1981 bottom. So and then the red line is not parallel with that. The market has not lifted all the way up to that parallel. Right. So that's what's going on. Okay, so now we're in this kind of tightening triangle. Yep. So just moving swiftly through the other four charts, the RUT divided by GC, so this is the Russell 2000 divided by gold, and I've drawn this kind of egg things. And my contention here is that we're commencing right now what had taken place in the prior egg, which is, you know, a hard fall, and that was down. That was in 2007, 2008.
The egg's going to break is what you're saying there. And the RUT is the yolk that's going to spill out.
We're using some egg metaphors. That's good.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
The next one, DJA. It's funny because I have eight chickens running around the backyard right now. DJA divided by SI. This is the Dow Jones Composite divided by silver. And just to mix things up, I'm using silver here instead of gold. And as you can see, in the late 90s and early aughts, there was a beautiful pink topping pattern, which fell hard and bottomed around 2011. And we are hammering out a similar pattern now. It's not quite complete, but I believe it'll get there. And these all have the same conclusion, which is, you know, equities down, precious metals up.
I want to say something because I want to make sure everybody's very clear about this. When you look at this, you know, you could say, well, why can't they just go up and go out? Yes. But remember, these are ratio charts. These are ratio charts. There's an important distinction in all of these, because what we're saying is when they peak out is when the ratio gets, let's call it, I'm just making it very easy to understand, possibly overvalued or overdone or overbought in one. So we're talking about when you peak out on the DJI slash SI, the Dow Jones average slash silver, means that the Dow Jones average has outperformed dramatically, and that's where we're getting those points and couldn't maybe break out. And again, ratio charts, important to understand that.
Right, but Andrew, it's so important what you just said earlier about the fact that that we could push right out of there. Patterns, it's very tempting to be like, it's 80% done, look what it's about to do. This thing could make an obscene gesture at me and push right above and go up to who knows how high. So until the pattern is complete, it is just information and it might happen. But as it is now, this is sort of larval. You know, it's like 80% done. And that's why I'm emphasizing, you know, because like when we're looking at the RUT, that's cooking. That's already done. Yeah, you know, going back to your egg thing, the egg's cracked. In this one, it's still in formation. Mm-hmm. Just two more quick charts. DJA divided by GC, exact same thing. It's just a different, instead of silver, we're using gold. Same notion here. The pattern is working its way toward what looks like a reversal, and it's not quite there yet. And the last one, just to show this is an all U.S. centric, is this crazy AWO1 slash GC. That's an all world index. It's just a very broad worldwide equity index divided by gold. So all these kind of speak the same thing. And so I think over the course of time, these are worth watching, because if it does continue to follow a path lower, some months from now, I believe the pattern will complete. And you know, it's extra fascinating because we are heading toward the election and the tumult that'll happen after that. And what I think is particularly troubling about this election is it's kind of a no-win situation, because whoever wins, half the country's going to hate the other half, which is kind of a sad state of America. Yeah. And it doesn't matter who wins. That will be the outcome. And I think that's just the kind of texture that you would expect in a really nasty economic shift that I think is going to be transpiring next
Pretty
year.
Cool. Well, Tim Knight, I want to thank you again. I hope that you know, your information here pans out well for you. And if anybody wants to get in touch with you, how do they do so?
Well, I'd love them to just pop on over to my website, which is slopeofhope.com. There's contact information there. And just to add one sentence, so I'm not a completely gloomy Gus about this, and the fourth turning speaks to this, it's not like the world's going to end, yay. It's more like we need a cleansing. This is how it happened. This is how it's always happened. And we will probably get to the other side of this in much, much better shape than we were before.
If that happens, if we get a cleanse, if we get a 30% downdraft,
yeah,
would you turn to the other side?
I would hope so. You know, I have missed so many opportunities to like get in cheap. So I would certainly hope so. But, you know, I've got kids. I want them to have a good future. And the thing is that, you know, in my view, we missed a golden opportunity in 2008 to have that cleansing. We basically, you know, the government didn't think we could take it, and they saved us, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And they've saved us again and again since then. At some point, they won't be able to save us. And I just think the cleansing is going to be ever that much nastier that we didn't kind of get it over with in the first place.
I will tell you this, Band-Aid. And I'll just close on this point, that I understand what you're saying, and I hear you. I will tell you, for everybody that's listening out there that also has missed those points and has maybe been maybe too negative or whatever it is, and missed maybe selling at good points, right? It goes both ways. Right, it goes buying on the bottoms or so. You're never gonna get the bottom itself. You know, I've dedicated a lot of my time to helping clients through some of this and helping them get back in, we call it, you know, 1 foot out, 1 foot in, and baby steps if you want, from lack of a better way to describe it. So, you know, think about it, folks out there that you know, there is a need to burn down the forest to a point, so that the forest can then come back that much stronger, which is exactly, I think, what you're saying, Tim.
Yes.
You know, and for the future, for the benefit of the next, you know, many generations. So yeah. I will take it upon myself. If we do see a bottom that I find is investable, I will call you.
Don't call me. Fly out and kick me in the butt and just make sure I click the buy button. Will you please?
Oh, dear.
I'll buy you a beer.
Thanks. Tim Knight, thanks for joining me. Appreciate it.
All right, sir. Thank you.
And there you have it. Both sides of the equation, right? We got the bull, we got the bear. You can believe either or none, and you can make your own decisions on where you're going to be investing your money. But I thought it would be really interesting to put that out there. Next week coming up, we have a great guest. We have Pat O'Hare from Briefing.com. I highly encourage you to tune in. I like Pat a lot. I love Briefing.com. A lot of information he always shares, so I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say. Thanks for joining me. Of course, go visit thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You want to know how we invest money, what we do, why we do it, and how it may fit your particular circumstance? Thedisciplinedinvestor.com is the way to get in touch. And for us to give you the information, whether it's your IRA, your 401k, your individual accounts, your trusts, all of that, your corporate accounts, all of that is what we do. TheDisciplinedInvestor.com. Thanks for joining me on this week, every week. I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.